Our text this afternoon is found in the second book of Samuel, chapter 14, and the verse 14. 2 Samuel, chapter 14, and verse 14. For we must needs die, and are as water spilt on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither does God respect any person, yet does he devise means that his banished be not expelled from him. Dead man walking. And that is the noise that rings out on death row in the American states where the death penalty is still legal. The noise as a sentenced criminal is brought to whatever means it would take to for which the death penalty would be administered. And this here is how our text begins, for we must needs die. And I don't mean to in any way sound to be scaremongering, nor do I intend to bring the mood of the place down. I know at the start of this verse it is a very morbid subject. But this is a text in which no word of this single text of 2 Samuel 14:14 can be argued with. And the text falls right in the middle of a family civil war. It's a part of David's punishment from God, which we can turn back a couple of pages to as to why and when that punishment was administered. I could have made Ethan read three chapters, but I thought just one would be fair enough. So we read that David, to all intents and purposes, was not one of the bad kings. He was one of the good kings. Christ obviously came from the line of David. But David, like all that sit in this meeting, was a sinner. And David may well have been one of the best of kings, but he was still a man at best. And what was the sin? Well, in 2 Samuel 11, we can read of the sin, which is where he looked out of his balcony and saw Bathsheba, and he coveted her. And he then sent for Uriah to go to the front of the front line of the battle. It says in verse 15 of 2 Samuel 11, set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, and retire ye from him, that he may be smitten and die. So the main reason for David sending Uriah there was that Uriah would die. Retire ye from him indicates that they were to leave him hung out to dry. And in 2 Samuel chapter 12, we have the parable of the ewe lamb, which comes from the prophet Nathan. And Nathan says this, and I'll just scan through it. It starts the end of verse 1, and the bit that I'm going to read ends at beginning of verse 3. There were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing save one little ewe lamb. The parable then goes on that the rich man took and killed this lamb. And incensed, it says in verse 5 that David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. And he says, as the Lord liveth, that man that has done this thing shall surely die, because he did this thing and because he had no pity. And then Nathan sternly responds to him in verse 7 with, thou art the man. And then in verse 11 we read this punishment, which leads to where we are in our text, verse of 2 Samuel 14:14. It says, behold, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house. David's punishment was not that he would die. David would have chosen that this man would die. But David's family would from then on be a trouble to him. And this was the start of David's fall. So that sets part of the scene. But then 2 Samuel 13 sets us right up to where we are in 2 Samuel 14. It's where Amnon commits incest with his sister. Absalom then causes Amnon to then be killed, and then Absalom then departs and flees the scene. And so it plants the impression, 2 Samuel 13, that Amnon wasn't much of a loss, but Absalom was. If you look at verses 32 and 33, David's nephew says that it, only Amnon only is dead. That's in verses 32 and 33, repeated in both. But then we look at the end of chapter 13, in verse 39, it says, David longed to go forth unto Absalom. So, and this is where our passage that we've read earlier picks up the story. David is mourning, not particularly mourning Amnon, but mourning Absalom. Yet still it is inconceivable to David to bring Absalom back after what he had done. And so we meet a couple of characters in this particular account. We have Joab, we have the woman of Tekoa, and obviously we have David himself. And first of all, I just want to have a little look at Joab. In 1 Chronicles 18, it says that Joab is head over all the host. So Joab is very high up in David's men. Joab is motivated to serve David, as he's close to David. And he observes that David is upset and can see that perhaps bringing Absalom back would be helpful to his cause. But Matthew Henry gives four reasons as to why Joab is so active in this matter. He says he was studious in gaining favour with David. He was a friend of Absalom and saw him as the rising sun. Joab also thought that he would gain favour both with Absalom and David if he could bring about their reconciliation. Thirdly, Joab was a statesman, so he saw this as the opportunity for a what they probably call nowadays as a PR stunt. And Absalom was loved by the people. Therefore, to bring him back would be a PR stunt for Joab. He'd be able to bring the king and the darling of the people back together. And Joab was himself a murderer. He murdered Abner a few chapters back. And so retrieving Absalom could be considered to corroborate his reprieve. They're the words of Matthew Henry. So the method that Joab goes about, it's a tried and tested method. We've just mentioned in the previous chapter about Nathan's method to get David to rethink of his ways. It was to bring a parallel case before him and then allow him to judge the culprit. Nathan was successful, as he would have been, as God had sent Nathan to him. And Joab believed that he also would be successful. So Joab turns to our second character, which is the woman of Tekoa. And we won't spend too much time analysing her because we want to get to the verse. But there's one thing that I think is very important that we point out. And that is the description that the Bible gives her. Joab sent to Tekoa and fetched thence a wise woman. This woman from Tekoa, we don't know her name, but she was labelled as a wise woman. And there's a stigma around the Bible and women. There are many, perhaps women these days, that would say, oh, I can't be a Christian because the Bible doesn't recognise the achievements of women. Women are treated unfairly. But then Esther saved her nation. Ruth is one of the few women mentioned in the genealogy of Christ. Mary Magdalene, if you read Matthew's account of the resurrection, is one of the most prominent people at the resurrection, besides Christ, of course, himself. And of no one else was it said by Christ, but of that one woman in Mark 14, verse 8, she has done what she could. And time obviously does not allow us to go further into Elizabeth, Martha, and the other three Marys of the New Testament. But if you have got a Thompson's Chain Reference Bible, there's a long list of women, and it might be worth your while to look into that. But this woman of Tekoa that we are looking at today, although is correctly given this wise woman label. And there's a lot of application that we Christians could gain from this woman. And some of this, of course, is Joab's idea. And it is that she met the need of David. She condescended herself to David's level. David was in mourning, and Joab told her to feign herself as a mourner and to put on mourning apparel. And so the sin-sick soul needs one who can minister to that soul, one that can show Christ through being relatable to that soul. And the Christian should not be careless in their delivery, but should be thoughtful. Jesus said, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." Matthew 10:16. So Joab gives this woman the mandate and sends her in to David. She tells her story. And remember the story of Absalom and Amnon that we've brushed over about the incest, the murder, and then the self-imposed exile. But let's rush through it, and we'll start at verse 6. I'm going to jump, so I'm not going to read it as it is written, but I'm going to read little sort of snippets of the verses. "Thy handmaid had two sons. They strove together in the field. There was none to part them, but the one smote the other and slew him. The whole family is risen against thine handmaid, and they said, Deliver him that smote his brother, that we may kill him, for the life of his brother whom he slew, and we will destroy the heir also, and shall not leave to my husband neither name nor remainder upon the earth." And David then offers his support to this woman and to the son, but she asks him one more thing, which we find in verse 13. She says this, "Wherefore then hast thou thought such a thing against the people of God? For the king doth speak this thing as one which is faulty, in that the king doth not fetch home again his banished." Hypocrite. She's calling him a hypocrite. The son that is in her version of events is getting full protection from a king who has never met him. And he'd have no affiliation with this woman or the son. Yet David is absolutely happy in himself to leave Absalom, his own son, in banishment. And then after our verse, we see that David gets a little bit suspicious about this. And he had wised up to this event. Perhaps he may have said to himself that he'd seen it all before. Obviously, it's a parallel case, just like Nathan's ewe lamb was a parallel case. And he may well have just gone, "This must be Joab." And the woman doesn't deny it, but does say that it is Joab. And what an example Joab is to us too, that he was so desperate to bring Absalom's redemption before David that he would use whatever he could to bring Absalom back. And are we like this with our friends, with our family that don't know Christ? Do we take the opportunities that God provides us to spread the gospel? Do we look to bring them under the sound of the gospel? Do we share the gospel with our friends? But we must get on with this verse 14. And without meaning to trivialise it, we could call this the death row verse. We have the verse from the mouth of the woman of Tekoa, and whether this was something that she was told by Joab to say or she ad-libbed it herself, but even so, it closed up the case to David. And we're going to break it up. We'll start off with the first bit, "For we must needs die." Straight to the point. We are all going to die. Unless the Lord returns before our number is called, there is a 100% possibility that everybody in this room, listening online, listening to the recording, will at some point die. One out of every one die. But why does this woman bring up death? Death has already happened. Amnon is already dead, and Absalom is still alive. Well, the importance of this is that David needs to make things right before either of the two die. And this is a reminder to David that if David was to die before things were made right with Absalom, they would never be made right. And if you're unsaved today, however morbid this may be, however sad to think about it, however dreadful the occurrence may be, death will be your final destination. Death is the only journey whereby you can guarantee 100% chance that you will get there safely. And if you're not right with God before the time you take that journey, there will be no further opportunity of redemption. This wise woman of Tekoa knew that David's relationship with Absalom was not where it should be. Can I be personal with you and ask you about your relationship with Christ? Is your relationship with Christ as it should be? I don't want to hear your answer. It's between you and the Lord. But I want you to get one in your head. If death came to you now, is your current relationship with Christ going to take you over heaven's threshold? We're just going to leave 2 Samuel 14 just for a minute as we're thinking about the relationship and go to Luke chapter 9. We're just going to read a couple of verses from Luke chapter 9. And these are what Jesus said to his disciples. Verses 23 to 26 of Luke chapter 9. And he said to them all of his disciples, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save it. For what is a man advantaged if he gain the whole world and lose himself or be cast away? For whosoever shall be ashamed of me and of my words, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he shall come in his own glory and in his Father's and of the holy angels." Just a few things to pick out about this relationship. Remember what we said about death, the certainty of death. And unless this event that Christ said about him coming in his own glory happens first, we will all taste death. But look at the audience of this monologue from Christ. He said to them all. This was universally applicable. These four verses are applicable to all men. And the second word I want us to point out is daily, which is in the fourth from last word in verse 23. Take up his cross daily. Two quotes from A.W. Tozer. The first one is this: "If you are not worshipping God on a Monday the way you worshipped him the day before, perhaps you are not worshipping him at all." And the other quote: "Go to church once a week and nobody pays attention. Worship God 7 days a week and you become strange." And Christ then goes on to talk about the material and the monetary pleasures. And it's good to note that material and monetary pleasures are not in itself sinful. It is the prioritizing of that material wealth over Christ that makes it sinful. It's idolatry. And after all, money is a concept. If I go to Spain with £150 notes, yes, I'm fairly rich, but I'm not going to be able to do anything with it because they obviously have a currency of the euro. So it's worthless. And most of all, there is no currency that can get you into heaven. No amount of indulgences can earn your place in heaven. And God's currency is grace and faith. And J.C. Ryle says this about death: "Death is indeed a cruel enemy. He makes no distinction in his attacks. He comes to the rich man's hall as well as to the poor man's cottage. He does not spare the young, the strong and the beautiful, any more than the old, infirm and the grey-haired. Not all the gold of Australia, nor all the skill of doctors can keep the hand of death from our bodies in the day of his power. When the appointed hour comes and God permits him to smite, our worldly schemes must be broken off and our darlings must be taken away and buried out of sight. Whosoever shall be ashamed of me and of my words, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed," we read in verse 26. Ashamed of Jesus, that dear friend, on whom my hopes of heaven depend, know when I blush, be this my shame, that I no more revere his name. I'm back to David's courthouse in 2 Samuel and in chapter 14. And the next part of the verse: "Are as water spilt on the ground." And here we see the finality of death and the irretrievable concept of time. Thinking back to those times, that in that environment, if water was to spill on the ground would be primarily dust or sand. And this is what the Scientific American website records. "If you pour water on the sand, the water seems to disappear into the sand. It doesn't actually disappear. It drains into the tiny pores between the grains. Once all these pores are filled with water, the sand is saturated, which means that the sand cannot take up any more water. When you squeeze that saturated sand, you would probably expect the water in the sand to come out of the pores again, similarly to what you would expect with a wet sponge. However, this is not the case. The exact opposite is the case. More water seems to disappear into the sand. And the reason for this is something called dilatancy of granular materials. And basically that means, dilatancy means that a material expands when you squeeze it instead of contracting. So the water drains into the sand, making it impossible for that water to then be gathered up to be retrieved. Just like life, time goes on and there's nothing that can be done to get back that time. And the events that have taken place cannot be replayed. C.T. Studd writes this, "Only one life, yes, only one. Soon will its fleeting hours be done. Then in that day my Lord to meet and stand before his judgment seat. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last." For David, the time he wastes before he brings Absalom back into his family will be the time that he will never be able to redeem. And for us, dear sinner or dear Christian, the redeeming of the time is vitally important. Without Christ, there is no time to waste to come before him. And with Christ, there is no time to waste in service of him. Horatius Bonar writes this, "Go labour on while yet 'tis day. The world's dark night is hastening on. Speed, speed thy work, cast sloth away. It is not thus that souls are won." And the next part of our verse can, on the face of it, look unloving or unmerciful, but it is nothing of the sort. It's neither doth God respect any person. God does not give people more than he intends to give, more time than he intends to give them. You will not live a nanosecond less than God intends, and you will not live a nanosecond longer than God intends. But the context points to death. God chose a couple of people, Enoch and Elijah, who would not die, but the rest of us, God does not give us the privilege of not seeing death unless the Lord returns first. Death will come to us all. And God does not respect any persons because all persons are under the same condemnation. The Bible says all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. That's Romans 3:23. And Ezekiel 18 verse 20, "The soul that sinneth, it shall die." This all sounds pretty dire, and from the outside looking in, this has been a fairly depressing sermon. But if we look at the punctuation that follows that last point that we made, where neither does God respect any person, colon. A colon is used to introduce words that explain something previously mentioned in that sentence. So the next part is just as relevant as we must needs die and the bits that follow that up until that colon. And the first word after the colon, yet, a conjunction. With all that has gone before, yet there is hope. God does not give anybody an out of death, from death, for we must needs die. But God doth devise means that his banished be not expelled from him. Yet there is hope. Yet there is an answer. Christ is that answer. How can a sinner remain a sinner and get to heaven? They can't. How can a sinner possibly get to heaven? Christ is the answer. How can another person born of a woman enable another to get to heaven? Christ is the answer. How can I get to heaven? Christ is the answer. Why, you may ask? Well, the conditions for heaven are simple. Perfection. Sounds simple, doesn't it? We've already failed. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. So if the condition for heaven is perfection, and it is already clear that you will not meet that condition, then you can't get to heaven. Well, that's false. That's not what I'm saying. Someone perfect has to live the perfect life. Someone sinless has to live the sinless life. Someone godly has to live a godly life. A price has to be paid. And in Mark 10:45, we see, "For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many." That's Mark 10:45. So if Christ has died, then surely all humans are going to heaven. No. Mark 10:45 says a ransom for many. So who are the many? John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." God so loved the world, those that are in the world. He gave his only begotten Son, the godly man, the God-man, Christ, that whosoever believeth in him, those of the elect that are called by God, chosen by God, that will be willing in the day of his power to believe in him, should not perish, but have everlasting life. And going back to 2 Samuel 14:14, we read, "Does he devise means he." God is the donor. There is nothing of ourselves that we can give to God. We can't argue our own works. God devises means. Salvation is from God only, of God only, and through Christ only. Death is not the end, not for the sinner, not for the Christian. And someone once said, we are all living in the departure lounge of life. It isn't the end, it's the new beginning. For the Christian, this new beginning will be everlasting life. Yet for the unbeliever, there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. And hell is not something to be thought of lightly, or to be spoken of lightly, or to be, but it is to be heavily avoided. And Jesus Christ said, as we mentioned to the children earlier, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. And you see in these wise woman's words that there is nothing in this entire verse, 2 Samuel 14:14, that we can disagree with. For we must needs die. We are all aware we are going to die. And are as water spilt on the ground which cannot be gathered up again. Time is not refundable. Neither does God respect any persons. All have sinned. Everyone in this world has done something which is against God's law. Nobody has done well enough to escape death. Yet, does God devise means that his banished be not expelled from him? Praise God that we have a Saviour. Be thankful to God that we have a gracious and merciful and omnibenevolent God, who, although we fail him regularly, he has devised means through Christ that his banished be not expelled from him. Dead man walking. Every person on the face of this earth is walking around with a death sentence upon their heads. Nobody is sure when, but to each of us it is appointed unto man once to die, but after this the judgment. Are you like Absalom today? Are you banished, away from God? What happens if your number is called before we sing the final hymn? Will I see you in heaven? And I finish with this from Leonard Ravenhill. The surest thing in this world is not death and taxes. It's death and eternity. Yet we're so unconcerned. 2 Samuel 14:14. For we must needs die, and are as water spilt on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither does God respect any persons. Yet does he devise means that his banished be not expelled from him. Amen.